So this is talking with Bruce Lee on 1st March 1978 at Radio Physics in Sydney. And could you please tell me about, you said you were a radar operator in the war. And
yes, well, I was a radar mechanic in the war. And I was stationed at a radar station in Darwin. One day in, I think it was October, November 45.
Just after the war was over, actually.
Just after the war was over.
Yeah.
We picked up strong signals from the direction of the sun as the sun was setting. I thought this was strange at the time, but I remembered that I'd seen some report that radio physics was interested in this kind of research, so I immediately sat down and wrote a report on what I'd seen and sent it to Dr. Pawsey. And he wrote back and expressed quite a bit of interest in what I thought was a discovery.
Mm-hmm.
And we set up an appointment later on to meet in Adelaide, and I got when I was discharged. And from then on, he offered me a job as a technical assistant in radio physics.
I see.
That's how I came to join the staff.
And that was 1946 when you joined the staff?
Yes, it was November 46 that I came across.
Did you ever do any more observation of the sun with that radar?
No, this was the only time it was really active. Some large sunspot group on the sun at the time.
Mm-hmm. What frequency was that?
This was 200 megahertz.
And I asked you before, but you don't remember of any reports circulating through from the New Zealand or Australian military at that time of solar interference?
No, the only report I'd seen was originated in radio physics, I think, and that had sort of been distributed, I think, around the radar stations.
But this was at the end of the war, though?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So you hadn't even seen Hayes' report?
No, I hadn't at that stage.
Came out in 42, of course.
No.
Okay, so you got here in 1946 at Radio Physics, and what did you find?
Well, I found quite intense activity and excitement. Everybody was mainly in the solar field at the time. Gooby Payne Scott, Dr. Pawsey, Lindsay McCready, John Bolton, and Gordon Stanley.
Mm-hmm.
I think Paul Wilde had just arrived on the scene. Everybody was working at that time on solar research. They had stations out at George's Heights on the harbour and one at Dover Heights.
Mm-hmm.
And the first first 3 months or so, I was working with Ruby Payne Scott and Don Yardsley out at George's Heights on solar work, mainly in the technical field, getting receivers going and not doing much analysis or that sort of thing.
Right, you were not trained as a scientist,
no,
per se.
No, I was not trained at all. I was more interested in the engineering side when I came into it. The technical side. But at the same time I began in 1947 the beginning to do a radio engineering diploma course at the Sydney Technical College.
I see.
And I continued that for 5 or 6 years.
And part-time?
Yes, all this time of course I was a technical assistant and mainly was interested in keeping receivers going and repairing aerials and doing some observations, doing quite a lot of observations at the time though. Shortly in, early in 1947, about March or April I think, I went out and joined John Bolton and Gordon Stanley at Dover Heights, and from then on I was mainly concerned with extraterrestrial work on sources.
Right.
And they had just at this stage discovered the radiation from the discrete source of Cygnus. And they were busy doing experiments with sea interferometers up and down the coast, going to higher and higher cliffs, trying to get better and better resolution, and mainly on Cygnus A to try and locate its position and angular size.
Right. How many different locations were there, actually?
Well, I think they tried, I started at Dover Heights, of course, but that was only a 200-foot cliff, and they, I think, went to Long Reef, which was 300 or 400 feet high. Palm Beach, I think they tried that. And then, late in 47, they went across to New Zealand.
Right.
Where they got 1,000-foot high cliffs on the both the east and west coasts of New Zealand.
I see, so they were much higher there.
Yes, yeah. And it was here that they located the source quite accurately and measured its angular size. And
you didn't go on that trip to New Zealand?
I didn't, no. I stayed at Dover Heights and did some carried on the experiments we were doing there at the time. We did some simultaneous work between here and New Zealand at the time. It's one of the first spaced aerial experiments on Cygnus A, because we were interested in the time and the intensity fluctuations of Cygnus A,
right,
whether they were inherent in the source or ionospheric. And of course we found that they were not correlated at the two sites. And
Did that result come out pretty quickly once you began this analysis, so there was never really much doubt in your mind?
Oh yes, that was quite a month or so after they returned from New Zealand, the analysis had been completed and we were quite sure that it was ionospheric scintillation.
Well, that's interesting. Now, this is 1947?
Yeah, the end of 47, early 48.
And of course you didn't publish this until 1950 in this paper we've been looking at, Stanley
right.
and Slee.
Yeah.
And yet, in the traditional history of this sort of thing, the two papers published in Nature by who was it now? Lovell and Smith, and then someone. Anyway, it was
Hay himself had found Cygnus from these Cygnus.
Right, but I mean, as far as establishing their ionospheric origin.
Yes.
There was a pair of papers in Nature in 1950.
Yeah.
Done one of the rare cooperations between Jodrell and Cambridge, in which they did the same thing that you're talking about, a little bit smaller baseline, and that's usually given the credit for having established this.
Yes.
But you're saying that 3 years before you...
Well, 2 years anyway.
You were pretty convinced that it was that way,
yeah,
but you didn't publish it right
quite
then.
Quite sure of it at the time, yes.
Do you remember particularly why?
I don't know. We didn't consider it particularly important, perhaps. I don't know.
Well, it was... in retrospect, though...
It does turn out that it could have been...
It seems to be rather
regarded
important.
As important, yes.
But it didn't seem... I'll have to ask John Bolton that also.
Well, of course, we continued on actually doing ionospheric work on scintillations from then on for several years and getting the seasonal and diurnal characteristics of scintillation activity.
But I'm just puzzled why you didn't sort of send a letter off to Nature about just the main result.
Yes, it is rather strange. It would these days, I'm sure.
Is it fair to say Gordon Stanley at this time was also in a similar sort of job as you?
He was rather higher up the scale. He was a technical officer. And he finished his diploma course at the Sydney Technical College. And once you finish your diploma, you usually became a technical officer.
I see. And then John Bolton would be a research officer, is that the right term?
A research officer at that stage, yes.
I see. Okay, well, the first publication that you're involved with is the famous Bolton, Stanley, and Slee in Nature, in which you suggest the identifications for Taurus, Virgo, and Centaurus A. And if you could tell me how this came about and how you got hooked into the optical side, I'd be interested.
Well, that came about as a result of the trip to New Zealand, really, because of they also observed Taurus and Virgo and Centaurus, as well as Cygnus over there, and were able to locate the position of the source much more accuracy than we could at Dover Heights.
Basically because of the much higher cliff?
Yes, because of the higher resolution. And, I just looked up the sky atlases and found that the position they gave had an accuracy of, a few minutes of arc.
Well, it's like 8 to 10 or so.
Yes. And the galaxies happened to be located within the Erebos. We suggested these as optical identifications. They were all fairly unusual looking objects. I think that was about the only reason to say that they were, at the time, were possibly associated with the radio source.
M87, of course, is not that unusual on a long exposure. It just looks like a normal elliptical galaxy.
Yes.
But it is a bright one, no doubt about that. But were you in contact with, I've heard Harley Wood was leading you on to some of this optical information. Were you at all involved in that yourself?
Well, at that stage.
That was John Bolton,
mainly,
talking to him.
I really came in on that paper because I was concerned with the equipment mainly.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the analysis, but none of the interpretation at that stage would have been due to me.
Right, and were you involved at all in the corrections for refraction for these positions and all that?
No, I didn't really do much of that.
Yeah.
John did most of it.
Okay, so I'll check with him. Because, of course, as you know, there were some that didn't turn out to be quite in the right position, because I guess in retrospect...
I think Cygnus itself was one of those.
Right.
They failed to identify Cygnus with the galaxy, I think, which...
But so since your main contribution at that time was with the receiver, let's just look at the Stanley and Slee paper. And in section 2, you talk about receiver problems having to do with receiver stability and interference. And you state that you almost had to observe in the wee hours of the morning. And even then, I guess it was not ideal.
No, well, of course, we had to use total power receivers at that stage.
Well, you talk about the Dickey system here, but, and you say that it's root 2 worse sensitivity. For some reason, you weren't willing to use it at that stage. Was that just sort of unfamiliar?
We had a pretty crude mechanical switch from the Dickey system. We didn't have any electronic switching at that stage.
Well, you didn't actually use it, I don't think, but you consider it here in this paper, that's what I'm saying. So that was the main trouble, was the switch?
Yeah, I found the mechanical difficulties that the switch prohibited its use. Generally, it was inferior to the DC system.
Was this going to be switching in and out a disk of some kind?
Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it exactly did.
But in fact, the Dickey system was, of course, set up for microwaves, primarily. Were there any differences that you had to... use if you're going to use it at something like 100 or 200 megahertz? Would it work just as well?
Well, of course, we had to find some way of balancing the... you're switching between a pretty hot sky and couldn't use a cold load, so you had to have a hot load of some sort to balance it against. And this, of course, would introduce some more instability, probably, keeping the hot load stable.
That's true. And, of course, there's less motivation to use a Dickey switch because of this. The signals are stronger, basically. You're not as subject to gain fluctuations. Or, I'm sorry, it's not as critical a problem.
Oh.
Would you agree with that? Or?
Well, you're limited more by the receiver, the noise background, the base frequencies, rather than the receiver noise temperature, of course.
Right.
And there's not that great incentive to use the Dickey switch there.
Let's see what else you discussed in this. Well, one question that came to mind as I looked at this paper last night is, why did you not go to a more remote site to get rid of the interference problem?
Well, I should think probably because of financial difficulties. Setting up a station well outside Sydney on a cliff somewhere would have been probably pretty expensive, mm-hmm. even in those days, to run.
Certainly not as convenient also, of course. But it seems like...
I certainly wouldn't have been able to get there. I was doing courses at the time.
Okay. Well, looking at this list of sources, there are 22 altogether. And they range down to 200 Janskis, as we say today, in intensity.
Mm.
Was this based on a complete... sky survey? How are you sweeping the sky, so to speak, to try to do this in a methodical
way? Well, we'd leave the aerial fixed on a star, say, well north, and leave it there for a couple of nights, and then swing it a beam with further around the horizon, do another long run, and just look for the interference patterns on the source, on the records.
Could you leave it unattended through the night, or did you always have
to... We used to be there. Somebody used to be there. It was quite exciting, really, those days. You didn't expect to find a new source at least every night.
and you did it, say, twice for just for confirmation?
Just confirmation, yes. And you had to wait 6 months to get the data on the section of the sky, and of course.
And so you could get it in the wee hours of the morning, you mean?
Right.
Yeah. There's another interesting column in this table, and that's number of observations. Where for Cygnus you have 320.
Yes. For those major sources, we looked at them almost as often as we could. We turned the aerials around just for a quarter of an hour or so each day, just to look at them.
I see.
And then go back to the survey.
And for the others, it's more like 10 or 20 typically. But
yes.
Still, it's one hell of a lot of observing going into this list.
Mm. We're interested mainly in the scintillation activity of 70 records on the stronger, four or five stronger sources.
Right. Was the equipment such that, what I'm trying to get at, what fraction of the time did it operate? Was it breaking down a lot?
No, it was pretty reliable on the whole. We had a lot of blackouts in those days, which was one of the main troubles. After the war, we had a lot of coal shortages and strikes. And
I see.
And for several years there, we often had blackouts.
You didn't have your own generator?
No.
Once again, was that just a financial problem?
I don't know why we didn't go in for a generator. We could have quite easily. There wasn't much power being consumed. It wasn't that. But the equipment was pretty reliable and it was pretty simple too. Just a straight super heterodyne with stabilized power supplies. A chart recorder, DC amplifier, chart recorder. And the aerials were rather simple. Things to, not much to go wrong with them. But normally we used to be somebody out there most of the night. And, in case there was a power failure and things had to be reset.
Mm-hmm. And here's another part of the paper where you talk about temporary sources, and there's one that you say may be a temporary source, which is an interesting terminology, meaning time variable, I guess. That must have been pretty hard to ascertain. I mean, the intensities that you got were probably trickier than the positions and the sizes, were they not? Or is that true? Getting accurate?
Yes, they were. I mean, of course, you were subject to some of the typical interference patterns, to refraction, which often, and scintillation, which was quite severe at the low frequencies. And,
right.
It was rather difficult to estimate the fringe amplitudes on many occasions. For instance, on this kind of record, it would be pretty difficult.
What were you using as your basic calibration source?
Noise diode. Absolute calibration standard at that time.
Mm-hmm. And were you trying to calibrate the other sources versus one, like Cygnus or Taurus?
We didn't attempt to use the sources themselves as known collaborators. We relied exclusively on the noise diode as an absolute intensity.
Okay, moving on in this paper, we come to the spectra, which is the first time, I believe, that anyone put together some spectra of sources at frequencies between 40 and 160 megahertz.
Yes.
And tell me about what you found and what you made of it.
Well, of course, we found that the only significant difference between the spectra, I think, was that the Crab Nebula was flat and the others were much more steep, much steeper. I think at the time, we interpreted this, did we not? I'm not familiar with the paper now, but in terms of the synchrotron.
No. This is before.
This was before Shlovsky and
yes.
Company, was it?
This is before synchrotron days. I've forgotten exactly what your comment was on that.
We probably didn't have any.
You say. The latter, Taurus, would be consistent with thermal radiation from an optically thin shell.
Yes, okay.
So, which is correct, of course. It is consistent with that. But that's all you say. Yeah. And then you also have a spectrum of the North Galactic Pole and a region around the galactic center, so that the galactic background, throwing in some other observations by Hay and so forth, you showed had a steep spectrum also.
Yes, I'm not sure how closely it coincides with present-day spectra.
No, that I haven't
checked.
That I haven't checked here. Over a factor of 4 in frequency, it goes down to a factor of 25 in brightness temperature. So it should be 4 to the 2.5, I guess, and then 1632 times 200.
Yeah, that's so getting on towards the same.
Yeah, looks pretty good. Okay, and the final thing is indeed the ionospheric fluctuations, and apparently you had observations from July 47 through June 49 that you recorded in this paper.
That's right. And Cygnus A.
Right, this is all the Cygnus A. And you've already said that you were quite convinced it was due to the ionosphere. There was one thing I wanted to check. You imply in the abstract that previously it had been thought to